This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. As always, you can join the conversation on our website, wnpr.org/The Wheelhouse. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse, or you can call us at 860-275-7266. The cameras of CTN, the Connecticut Network, they're back with us today, so welcome to their viewers. And welcome, as always, to Colin McEnroe. He's the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Hi there, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky.
Also with us is Caitlin Krassel. She's political reporter at Hearst Connecticut Media. Hello there, Caitlin.
Hello, good morning.
And Dan Haar is here. He's editor and columnist at Hearst Connecticut Media. Hi there, Danny.
Hearst. Hi.
Yeah, so it's an all Hearst program. It's a week before the primary, actually a little less than a week before the primary. We're going to start with the Republicans this week, the Republicans running for governor. I had the pleasure, the privilege of moderating a debate earlier this week at Fairfield University. The five Republicans who are vying for the nomination were all there, and I was expecting to be in the middle of a wrestling match because we've been hearing an awful lot of back and forth between the candidates, both on stage when they have had an opportunity to debate and also in their paid media, a lot of name calling. So I thought that that's what it would be like. And instead, Colin, it was something very, very different. They all calmly answered questions, or mostly answered questions, and then moved on. They declined any attempts to rebut even once any of the other candidates. So what's going on? I thought that a week beforehand, we might have a little bit more fire here.
Well, first of all, it's been quite a while since Mark Davis and Ken Dixon had a wrestling match, so I don't know what you were worried about. I think probably, I mean, it's really hard to know, and I was talking at some length to two Republicans last night about this. I mean, you know, people have internal polls, people have ways of trying to gauge all this stuff, but the truth is nobody really knows. I mean, it's probably down to a four-person race. Sitnick, I think, is kind of a dead man walking at this point, just because he didn't get his money and his campaign going.
If you've heard his campaign, though, a dead man hugging. He wants to hug everyone. But anyway, please continue.
He wants to hug everybody. Mark Batten wants to strap himself to I-95. This whole thing is getting kind of an erotic quality. But so I think in a situation like that, you're trying to be a little bit mistake-free anyway. You don't want to do something that would cause you to plummet, would drive anybody away from you. If I had to guess as to why people were being a little bit more careful with their demeanor, at this point now, you know, they probably have a little bit of internal research telling them that when they engage in hostile behavior, it drives up their negatives. They don't want to drive up their negatives right now. I mean, the one thing that we know is that on August 14th, this thing is going to be won in some kind of, with some small number of voters. So, I mean, you really have to be kind of careful about who you alienate and how you try to, you know, maintain whatever kind of base you've accumulated here.
Danny, do I mean, yeah, does that sound right?
To sharpen that point a tiny little bit, four people think they can win. And maybe five. I talked to Steve Obsitnik yesterday. He's a great candidate, and he's not in the classic sense dead man walking, because he still has a great, in his view, message. And he knows what we were just talking about, that 35 to 42 or 3,000 wins it, maybe as low as 30, but I would argue 35 to 40, let's say, wins it. And as Colin said, in that situation, anybody can win, including him. So they're not being negative precisely for the reason Colin said, because not only because in the last week you are seen as negative if you go negative, but because they actually think they can win, and they're right, they can.
But Caitlin, what then ends up happening during a debate like the one we had on Monday, not that the entire world is watching these debates, but it is an opportunity for these candidates to distinguish themselves from one another. We still, I think, quite realistically have an issue between two business people, Bob Stefanowski and David Stemmerman, who were not known by anybody in the state before this campaign. And there are probably a few folks who can't quite tell the difference between these two guys who have a lot of money, whose names start with S and who don't seem to like one another. The only way that they can differentiate themselves is coming out with their plans. But we've got a 10-point plan here, a 5-point plan here, Steve Obsitnik's 5 + 8 = 13, or whatever his plan is. I mean, are these plans enough?
No.
I mean, what are you hearing from the candidates on the trail? Because I keep hearing the same thing. Here's my 5-point plan for solving this, but I don't know that I can make any distinction between the candidates.
I mean, that's exactly it. They all say these things that kind of sound similar. They talk about the pensions and the budget crisis, and Bob Stefanowski can only talk about the economy. And Stemmerman has this plan, and he's taking it to the unions, and he's going to take it to court. And they all kind of sound the same. But in order to really differentiate between them, you have to be like we are out on the trail and see them in those places. And a lot of people just aren't doing that right now.
Colin, I have to say, our colleague Mark Pazniokas from the Connecticut Mirror, who is with us on the panel, asked a couple of interesting questions. He really started off by saying, you know, should you take should we take what you're saying on the campaign trail literally? When you say that you are going to do this and then that and then this will occur, should we assume that that's a broad brush way that you're looking at the world of governing the state, or are you going to do these things? Mark Bowden basically said, this is a framework. This is what we think we're going to do. When I'm going to get rid of the income tax, it's going to take some time, and it's something that I'm attempting to do. Stemmerman, Stefanowski, they said, no, this is exactly what's going to happen. I'm going to take on the unions. I'm going to cut out all this money out of state government. So I don't know. What should we believe?
Well, I mean, some of that also reflects the different experiential levels, right? I mean, so Boughton understands, because he has governed. He has governed, you know, a halfway decent-sized city in Danbury, that in fact, you can't have a plan and stick to it because there are too many other players and there's too many other circumstances that arise that might disrupt your plan. And so I think there's sort of that, you know, that the people who have some experience in politics and governing, they kind of know that a campaign is a heuristic as opposed to a perfectly accurate statement. I would say this in terms of differentiation. I think the differentiation has kind of gone this way. Herbst has basically played it for game theory, and game theory dictates that you get to one extreme, so you don't have anybody, at least on one side of you, you have no competition. So he's gone as far to the right as he can.
Lumage is gone.
Yeah, well, because of Caitlin.
Yes.
Because Caitlin destroyed the career of Peter Lumage. So he's got nobody on his right, which is probably a pretty smart tactic. He's also probably appealing a little bit more to, say, let's say a middle class or working class base with the kind of rhetoric he's using. And the other thing that he's doing that's a little bit different from Stemmerman and Stefanowski is he's just personally out on the trail using shoe leather, or I guess you want to make the point it's actually boot leather.
Nice set of boots that he wears on stage, which I found interesting. An interesting choice during a Republican debate. We'll have another
Kinky
segment
boots?
About that. That's what you said. It's not what I said. To Colin's point here, if we have these people trying to differentiate themselves a little bit by where they're going to be on the overall spectrum, I know, Dan, that Bob Stefanowski has in some of his paid media and some of the alerts that I've been getting, still aligning himself a little bit more with President Trump than I guess I would have expected, but maybe that's what you do expect during a Republican primary.
Well, it's partly personality, and we've been talking about issues, and people have been dutifully not listening to issues. We should also talk about personality types. On a spectrum, and I'll do this quickly, Colin, on a spectrum, you have on one side the manager traders. These are the people with the, you know, guts and glory. They want people to follow them. And that's your Stefanowskis and your Herbst. I'm not saying this is not talking about effectiveness.
You mean Stefanowski and Stemmerman?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. No.
No.
You think
Stefanowski and Herbst, the trader mentality, the say anything, go for it mentality, the I want you to follow me mentality. Mm-hmm. And on the other side, you have your analyst inventors, right? And your analyst inventors are Obsitnik and Stemmerman, right? They're thinkers. They're analysts, right? They have big plans. They have invented things. They've started companies. Boughton is in the middle on that spectrum. And that's one of the reasons that Stemmerman and Stefanowski don't get along, because they're both laying claim to the guys whose names start with ST and have a whole bunch of money and did well in business and are conservative Republicans. But in a personality difference, that's really where they stand out. And again, Boughton being in the middle may benefit him.
I think that that's a very interesting spectrum that you've laid out. Can you put all the candidates for all these races on this Dan Haar spectrum?
You are on far end of one. I'm not saying which one.
Which end? But you've been writing, Caitlin, about David Stemmerman. We were talking about his various plans. I mean, we've mentioned this already. One of the things he's saying, because we're asking them for specifics about what are you going to do about this gigantic problem of the state budget deficit, and he says, well, I'm going to sit down with unions, and they're going to listen to what I have to say, and we're going to solve this problem of all of these pension benefits. And I asked him afterward, like, so you're going to go to court. Like, is that how you're going to handle it? Because I don't know what else is going to happen. What's he saying?
I mean, that's exactly what he's saying. He told our editorial board, you know, he thinks that they will cooperate because the unions were dealt a pretty significant blow with the Janus decision, and he thinks that they won't want to take another hit. But his entire plan hinges on the unions either cooperating and going along with this plan. He's going to pay them out in a lump sum And if they don't do that, he fully intends to take it to court. And it's kind of a strange thing to hinge your entire plan on, because that takes time and it doesn't necessarily work.
Well, and that decision, Colin, I mean, it may well affect the health of unions moving forward, but it doesn't have a darn thing to do with the people who have negotiated for union rights and have, like, contractual money coming to them. That's a very different thing.
Right. It's a little bit of a roll of the dice, and a lot of it would also depend on whether or not you got to stay, right? So it could play out one of two different ways. One of them could be that the governor gets to unroll his plan while the unions protest and bring this thing to court where it will be decided. But the first thing that they would want to do is seek a stay. And if they didn't get it, you know, the governor, whoever the governor is, would have a certain amount of time to do all this. I still would agree with Caitlin. This is, you know, it's a strange place to begin. I quickly also want to say, just in terms of, like, how people are sorting themselves out. And by the way, I agree with Danny that Obsitnik was a really good candidate. And also, I think the only one of the five who has said he didn't vote for Trump and has really, you know, put some daylight between himself and Trump. But good candidate, smart candidate.
Well, Stemmerman criticized Trump for a couple of things as well.
Okay, so I think what's happened, what I'm seeing a little bit, is that some of the insiders, and we're not talking about a lot of people here, but some of the people who were for Obsitnik have kind of gravitated over towards Stemmerman. They, I don't know how to do like a Myers-Briggs spectrum the way Danny did, but they're sort of also like the kind of smart people candidates, the candidates who are appealing to smart people who understand a lot of things and like ideas and stuff like that. And Stemmerman has begun to collect a lot of those people, at least at the upper echelons of the party. But, you know, the other question that I have, and I don't know if anybody has a working hypothesis, is who is around to vote on August 14th? I mean, there'll be some absentee ballots, but, you know, one theory that I had was that some of Herb's rhetoric seems to be directed a little bit more acutely at, say, middle-class to working-class people who probably aren't going to be on Martha's Vineyard on August 14th. Whether that helps them or not, I mean, we're doing some guesswork here, but that whole question of how many people turn out, is it 80,000, is it 100,000, is it more, and who are those people? As usual, that may have a lot to do with who wins.
Well, who has a thought about that? I mean, I think that's one thing we have to figure out, who's going to be around and who the people who will be around might want to vote for. I always look at things like lawn signs, Danny. I don't know. I drive around and I take a look at lawn signs. And when we're talking about a couple thousand votes here and there for a primary, where I live in Litchfield County, I see an awful lot of Stemmerman signs. I sure do.
Yeah, he's got a lot of signs out. I know at the Hearst debate, there were a whole bunch of Stemmerman signs, which was odd considering that it was really more of a studio debate. There were about 30 or 40 members of the just general public there. So they were, I don't know who exactly they were swaying, but as my state rep, Andy Fleischman, who we're going to maybe talk about in the next segment, says, tweets don't vote, lawn signs don't vote, and no social media votes. So it's a tough way to gauge, because it's just who puts up those signs.
I did see an awful lot of young people with Stemmerman shirts on at the last debate. More people organized holding up David Stemmerman signs than any of the other candidates, Caitlin. I went and waded into the crowd of these young people and said, so why is David Stemmerman your guy? Because he's my guy. And I don't know that there was a thought much beyond that, and I have no idea whether or not they've been employed to come out and handle these signs. Are you seeing any particular, I don't know, enthusiasm as you go out to either debates or campaign rallies or anything else that might suggest that one person is going to turn out more people next Tuesday than others?
I honestly have no idea. I mean, as the token millennial in the room, I affiliate with a lot of millennials.
I resent that you're token millennial. But anyway, please.
I mean, I talk to a lot of people in that age demographic, and a lot of them are not going to go vote next Tuesday. They're just not paying attention right now. They'll vote in November.
They'll vote in Idaho.
Yeah. Well, no, they won't vote there.
That's really what she's saying is really important, particularly in the next segment as we get to the Democrats. If it's a predominantly older vote, that will affect materially a number of races in the statewide ticket, and also, for example, the race that Andy was just referring to. I mean, we talk about that as we go along, but if the young vote stays home and decides they're going to vote in November, that will change all kinds of things, particularly in the Democratic dynamics.
Well, then let's just assume it's an older vote, as primaries tend to be, Colin. Then do we care at all that David Stemmerman is touting publicly the fact that the Hartford Courant has endorsed him? This is a big deal that the Hartford Courant has stepped out and endorsed a Republican candidate in this primary. Should that matter? Does that matter?
I don't think it's going to matter very much for the base. The base, I mean, first of all, newspaper endorsements exist only to be used in advertising. I mean, people don't read newspaper endorsements and go, oh, I think I ought to vote for that guy then. I mean, they've never had that particular effect. But you can use them in your advertising. And it can, you know, it can be one thing that differentiates you from everybody else. But I would say with the Republican base, they're not going to be that impressed with the Hartford Current. I want to say one thing just before I forget to say it, and it could go in either one of these segments, but there's a way of thinking about this where winning the governorship isn't the greatest thing for either party. That I think if you ask the leaders of either of the parties in a truly honest sodium pentothal moment, what would you like to have the most? A lot of them would say, I would just assume that the other party get the governorship and we control the legislature, because the governorship for the next 4 years is going to be a pinata. And governors tend to take the blame for stuff. Legislatures have a little bit more control and blame is diffused a little bit more. So, I mean, nobody intentionally ever throws an election or loses an election. But if it shakes out that way for either party, believe me, they'll be happy.
I'll go you a step further. If I were a very strong partisan Democrat, I'd rather have the AG and lose the governor than have the governor and lose the AG in an age of Trump. AG is the key spot right now in Trump.
I'd like to just quickly ask you, Danny, because I knew you wanted to mention this. What about the lieutenant governor candidates? I mean, is there anything that we should be divining about the potentials, especially on the Republican side, for people who could be paired with one of these Republican frontrunners?
Well, three of the five are liabilities for their ticket, and both are in the Democratic side. And that's just the cold, hard reality. That's, you know, sorry. So on the Democratic side, both lieutenant governor candidates will be both a help and a hindrance in the general election. One because she's viewed as being a sort of stolid insider. Is that the right word? Insider, that's Susan Bisewitz, and Ava Bermuda Zimmerman because she's viewed as being young, relatively less experienced, and mostly an employee of a state employee union, and so rigid on that. Whether she is or not, I don't know, and I actually don't think she'll be as rigid as people think. But those are the perceptions. And Joe Markley on the Republican side is such a – he has the highest ratio of being a really nice guy and a really, really, really off-the-wall conservative. And I joked with him about it. He said, yeah, I even look like a liberal, don't I? I said, you sure do.
Do you have any thoughts about the lieutenant governor candidates?
I mean, Dan's exactly right. On the Democratic side, Susan, to her credit, has a lot of experience, but she also has alienated a lot of people over the years, and that's the downside of being in politics for so long. And then Ava has, you know, she has that union affiliation, and you know, as Susan keeps pointing out, the lieutenant governor is one breath away from the governor's office, and I think that makes Ava.
I have certainly, however, noticed maybe amongst the millennial crowd that you have affiliated yourself with earlier, Caitlin, much more enthusiasm for Ava Bermuda Zimmerman as a lieutenant governor candidate than you would normally see enthusiasm around anyone running for that job.
Yeah, absolutely. I think millennials like Ava Bermuda Zimmerman and they like Aaron Stewart. But like I said earlier, will they vote?
Yeah. Colin, a thought on the lieutenant governor real quick before we break?
Well, I mean, what people tend to forget about the lieutenant governor job is it really is mainly the job of you should be – I mean, it has a political function. That's what we're talking about right now. When it turns into a job, the job is you actually have to be ready to run the state if for some reason or other the governor can't. And, you know, in my lifetime, it's happened twice. Bill O'Neill had to take over from Ella Grassow, and Jordy Rell had to take over from John Rowland. These aren't – isn't that far-fetched that it might happen. And I just – the only thing that I ask people when they vote is try to imagine the person you're voting for as governor, because that really could happen. I mean, that's the reason this job exists. It doesn't exist for much of any other reason. And a number of people who run for this job do not – even really think that through all that carefully at first either. You know, they're looking for a spot on the ticket or, you know, looking for a stepping stone or something like that. They don't think, well, you know, I think I could probably run the state pretty well for 3 years if so-and-so keels over. But I mean, you know, people should really think about that.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, if the Republican debate that I moderated the other day was a bit of a snooze fest, there was a bit more fire and smoke yesterday as the Democrats took on one another. We're going to talk about the Democratic side at the top of the ticket with Colin McEnroe from The Colin McEnroe Show on Connecticut Public Radio, Caitlin Krasold, who's political reporter at Hearst Connecticut Media. Also from Hearst Connecticut Media is Dan Haar. He's an editor and columnist there. I'm John Dankosky. This is The Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. You can always join our conversation at WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. If you'd like to call us about the week's news, 860-275-7266. We're less than a week away from the very important August 14th primaries. I'll just use this opportunity to say, go out and vote. Prove us wrong. We keep talking about how we're not going to have a very big turnout next Tuesday, but if you are affiliated with one of these two parties, please go out and vote. If you are unaffiliated from any party, like myself, you have a whole day to just hang out and watch what's going on. We're talking, as always, with Colin McEnroe, the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Hey, Colin, what's on your show today?
Today we are doing a show. First of all, this is going to be produced by one of our interns, Jason Perez, and it's about the notion of disability. What constitutes a disability? What's a real disability? And kind of how these things get understood and processed by society, by employers. I don't know. I'm not doing a very good job of laying out the groundwork of this. I should say that the show will, I think, end with Jason, who is now what we call a little person, although I think that's never been really, you know, they need a better term than that. But he's been a terrific intern here, and we had another terrific intern who was also a little person, Lila Call. She's going to come back. The two of them have
Lila's going to be here.
She's not going to be here in studio, unfortunately. We couldn't make that happen. They're going to have a conversation, though, about sort of how they live in this world and what that's like. One thing that's really interesting about disabled people is that they're really good at they're the original life hackers, right? They solve problems. They don't even talk about the problems that they solve, but basically all day long there's something that doesn't work and they figure out how to make it work. That's one of the big things we're going to emphasize on this show today.
That should be very interesting. Colin McEnroe this afternoon at 1 o'clock. Also joining us today are two members of the mighty Hearst, Connecticut media organization, Caitlin Krasold, a political reporter, and Dan Har, editor and columnist. They're both here to talk about the week's news, including politics. We've been talking about the Republicans so far. Well, yeah, our GOP debate that I took part in with some of my colleagues, a little bit of a snooze fest. No one wanted to mix it up. Ned Lamont and Joe Ganim, however, on the Democratic side, did want to mix it up with Dennis House at WFSB at their studio. The debate ended with a clearly peeved Lamont saying he would probably not support Ganim in the general election if Ganim beats him in Tuesday's primary. Here's a bit of what led up to Lamont's confession.
You laid off 70% of your employees. You can't do that.
That last comment is a lie. He knows it's a lie, and he knows it's false, and that's the problem. It's the same old Joe. But let me tell you a little bit about...
It's the same old Joe Lieberman, then, and the same old Dan Malloy, because I'm not the one who raised him. It's been raised in every one of your elections.
If you'd just let me finish, I'd really appreciate it.
So that's Ned Lamont, who I know a little bit, getting visibly upset with Joe Ganim. He later says, Dan, you know, I don't know if I'd support Joe Ganim if Joe Ganim wins the primary. Very different than what we just heard on the Republican side.
I think Ned has, in the same dynamic we discussed before, every advantage in laying back and not doing what he did. And I think he gave something up by being drawn into that battle. He didn't need to say, I'm not going to say. He could have just stuck to his non-answer. It's worked for a lot of people so far. And he doesn't have to answer the question. He answered the question, and he probably a little bit hurt himself. Does that mean that Ganim has a path to victory? I don't know.
I don't know. What do you see in this, Caitlin? Because, again, we've had an awful lot of back and forth on the Republican side, and then, you know, the candidates deciding at this last moment not to be feisty. Joe Ganim understands it's in his best interest to get under Ned Lamont's skin, seems to have done that.
I mean, Joe has come into this as the underdog. His entire video ad was him boxing. Like, his whole strategy is just to get under Ned's skin and see what he can do. He has nothing to lose. So, I mean, I think Ned is getting drawn into that. But at a certain point, how many hits do you take before you respond?
That's a good question, Colin.
I think that, I mean, first of all, I think most of us assume that Ned Lamont is going to win on Tuesday. But I don't think that's a guarantee. Once again, if there's a low turnout, the way that you typically win Democratic elections, the way the Democrats win, they go into cities and win, and they have vote pullers there. They have people really good at managing turnout. Those people really cannot function very easily in Ned Lamont's behalf. So Ned Lamont is going to have to win this election in other places around the state. And what is he holding up now?
It's probably going to take 80,000 to win.
Yeah.
And that's more than are going to vote in Bridgeport, New Haven, Hartford.
Oh, yeah.
And all the other cities.
There's another group of Democrats who were they're mostly progressive Democrats, who were just very unhappy from day one with the Lamont-Bicewicz ticket. They didn't like it. They tend to be younger. And as I say, they skew far to the left. I don't know whether they're willing to burn down a village to save it, but there's been some talk of that, you know what, Ganim can't win in the general election, so let's vote for him to show our displeasure with Lamont and Bicewicz. and we'll wind up with Stemmerman as governor and we'll try to control the legislature. That to me seems like a very risky strategy, but I have heard it out there anyway.
I just want to go back to you, Dan, on this, though. I mean, yes, perhaps Ned Lamont didn't need to take the bait there. Maybe that's not the most helpful thing for him. As Caitlin said, how many times are you going to listen to some of these things before you respond? In some ways, it almost seems as though he didn't respond forcefully enough. He said, I probably wouldn't support Joe Ganim. I guess I'm wondering why it's not a very clear thing for Ned Lamont to say, no, I'm not going to support Joe Ganim, because Joe Ganim went to prison for 7 years for taking money while he was in charge of the city of Bridgeport. We don't really want that again. It happened at the state capitol once, remember? We probably don't. I mean, it just seems like something that the guy in front should say in order to make it clear what the stakes are for the Democratic Party.
Yes, and he even said he wouldn't welcome Bill Clinton to campaign for him, which I was surprised about because I thought they were a little bit more aligned than I might have imagined him thinking.
Was Bill Clinton going to come?
No, the question came up at the debate. Would you, if Bill Clinton came to support you, would you welcome him here? And Lamont said, no, I wouldn't. And so, I was a little surprised about that. Maybe it's consistent along the lines of, well, you know, he did lie to Congress. But
I bet you would if I volunteered. I bet you would welcome me.
Yeah, I bet he would, too.
I bet you'd say yes.
I bet he would, too. But Lamont, left open the question for a while that he would run under the Working Families Party. And by not answering the question about Ganim, he left that open. Apparently, he did tell reporters that he would not do that.
He did.
That he would not run on Working Families and would not seek signatures. He could also seek signatures and get on the ballot, 7,500 by September 5th, certified by September 5th. And we may get to that with Oz. But that's, he could actually conceivably do that, too. By saying he's not going to do that, he's locked himself into a position where he's basically not supporting anyone.
Aside from the getting under Ned Lamont's skin and probably trying to just realign a lot of votes from Bridgeport, are you seeing widespread enthusiasm on the campaign trail, Caitlin, for Joe Ganim?
I am when I go to Bridgeport. And
and you're right there. You're right next door.
And, I've covered a couple of things in New Haven, but the things that, the places that I've seen in New Haven are places that he already had a lot of support. He brings a lot of people with him to these events, and so it's hard to tell how many people are there organically and how many are there because he asked them to be. Other than that, I'm not sure how much support he has out there.
I think one interesting question. I mean, I this is all very, very far-fetched, obviously, but just for to stay in shape or something, let's just think about it for a second, that Ganim somehow or other did win. You would have a ticket that would be unable to campaign together because most of those people will not get up on a stage. I mean, Denise Merrill is not going to get up on stage with Joe Ganim. I'm guessing that Chris Matty, if he were to win the AG's race, would not stand on a stage with Joe Ganim. You would have a guy at the top of the ticket that the rest of the ticket would be treating like a social leper and a political leper for the entire campaign. I think, in general, one thing that's going to happen on the Democratic side this year, you could have a ideologically very disparate ticket. I mean, imagine that Eva Bermudez-Zimmerman is the lieutenant governor and Paul Doyle is the attorney general nominee. She's about as far to the left as you can go. He's as far to the right as you can go and still be a Democrat. You might have a pretty diverse ticket as it is, but with Ganim at the top, you really would have a ticket that would be running away from its own top.
Well, let's actually switch topics, Colin, and talk a bit, if we could, about what's happening with the General Assembly. We don't spend a whole lot of time on General Assembly races, especially when we have an open seat for governor and some of these other statewide races that are so interesting. We haven't even talked this week at all about the 5th Congressional District race, which is so very important. But we've got some General Assembly races that are actually really quite fascinating. I might say a little bit about what the state's going to look like and how it's going to be governed next year.
Right. Well, now these are races that can be won by really handfuls of votes. These are races in some cases where 650 votes could actually win an election, which you have a bunch of different things going on here. You've got incumbent Democrats being challenged for the most part by more progressive people within their own party or younger people within their own party or both. You've got some seats that are open. The Schlossberg seat is open, for example. So you've got that Rocky Hill.
Bristol as well.
Yeah, Bristol. So you get the seats that are open where both parties can fight over them. And some of them are in pretty swingy, tippy districts. I mean, Meriden, for example, is a very swingy, tippy kind of area, where Susio and Bartolomeo flip back and forth. So you've got all of those things, and you've got a real incentive to try to control the General Assembly, too. As I said before, there really is, there's sort of an advantage to controlling the General Assembly and maybe letting the governor from the other party take his lumps. By the way, we should say that the next governor of Connecticut will be a white male from Fairfield County. There is no scenario except for Oz Griebel.
Stefanowski lives in Madison.
Oh, that's right, Madison.
But he made his name in Fairfield County.
All right. So, okay, a white male from downstate. I'll change it. But anyway, these races, they're going to be worth watching. They're going to be very hard to follow on election night and on primary night. But they're going to be worth watching, and they will have significant they'll change things in the composition of the legislature.
Any thoughts on this, Dan?
The Senate has, I think, five open seats. Although Ed Gomes being one is, I guess it's a lock for a Democrat. Maybe it's not. Actually, maybe that's not. So let's say there are five. I think five, maybe even six open seats. So the Republicans are really going to put a whole lot of energy into that. As Colin already said, the Milford seat could go. The Bristol seat, certainly. So a lot can happen in that. And I think if the Republicans take the Senate, it really does affect the governorship. Of course, if Lamont wins, and there's a Republican, a whole lot isn't going to get done. So if there's a divided, truly divided, not 18-18 with a tiebreak, but a truly divided governorship and one or two of the houses, then you're really not going to see a whole lot of these campaign promises happen.
I have a question for Caitlin, and it's based on something that Danny said. He was quoting Andy Fleischman, who's also my state representative. And Andy said, lawn signs don't win, social media doesn't win, tweets don't win, stuff like that. That's an assumption. It's an assumption about that the way things have always been is the way that things are now. It's an assumption by an older legislator. Danny's in his 50s. I mean, Andy's in his 50s.
So am I.
And so are you. Andy's in his 50s. He's running against Jillian Gilchrist, a younger person. There's no ideology. You couldn't slide a credit card between their two ideologies. There's no ideological policy difference from between this. She's essentially running as a younger woman going against a guy who's had this seat for a really long time. But I sort of wonder about the quote that Danny gave us from Andy Fleischman, because we don't know whether that's true anymore. We don't really know, particularly if young people did turn out in a primary like this
one. So lawn signs vote now?
Well, lawn signs don't vote. But,
do they register?
But a strategy based on networking, a strategy based on the new kind of networking could actually be a pretty effective strategy. I don't know. I wonder, as the representative of an entire American generation, what you would like to say about that.
I think that not enough credit is given to networking. I was talking to Ava Bermudez-Zimmerman, who also identifies as a millennial, and she was telling me about these people that have showed up to her events, young people. And it's because they heard about it on Facebook. They got invited to an event. And sure, lawn signs don't vote and tweets don't vote. But there is something to be said for networking and this new wave of people getting involved. Whether or not they actually turn out next Tuesday, again, is a different question.
But I also find it interesting what Colin's saying, Caitlin, about this Andy Fleischman-Gilchrist race, which is some of these, not just in the state, but national races in which you have a younger person who is running to the left versus a more established Democrat who represents the traditional base of the party. That is something we've seen play out. But sometimes it's just about change. It's not about, like Eva Bruner-Zimmerman saying, this is an entirely new way that the party should look. This is really about two people who are saying all the same things, but one's just a younger woman. That feels like a different thing than what we've been seeing in sort of a national movement right now.
Yeah, I think it is. I think that you're exactly right. And I think it's a result of 2016 where people just want to see someone different. You can say the exact same things, be the exact same candidate, and people want to see something different. I think the 5th District is a good example of that. Jahana Hayes has gotten a lot of support purely because people want to see something different. Her and Mary Glassman don't differentiate themselves that much on policy. They're pretty similar. But Jahana is getting a lot of support, and it's because people want to see something different.
We got a couple of interesting tweets here. Somebody tweets, don't know if any young people who want to deliberately back Ghanem to sabotage Lamont in the name of chaos, as you reported, that would be me. Young people want Eva. Between my girlfriend and my family, we support Ghanem. We are afraid Boughton will eat Lamont alive. Interesting. And then somebody says, can you all talk about the Dem AG race? There was a debate in New Haven last night. I don't know if we have time for the AG race. But
I will cede some time to you to talk about that briefly, because it is an interesting race that we've only spent a little bit of time on. We've mentioned Chris Matty briefly.
Yeah, I would say, once again, we're back to talking about what kind of wave this is, right? So if, in fact, Caitlin's generation stays home, that and if progressives stay home, that affects all kinds of races. But this one in particular, Chris Matty will win, I think, if young voters come out and if people who really want change come out. If not, then the advantage falls more towards either Doyle or Tong. You've got a three-member race. Matty is the most different of the two, and that may also favor him a little bit, you know, that he's different enough from Tong and Doyle that he might stand out. They might have to fight over the same kind of status quo type votes.
What's notable in the AG race is that the AG real spectrum is not an ideological spectrum, but it's an activist spectrum,
yep, yep.
Where Lieberman and certainly to a greater extent Blumenthal were the ultimate activist. Blumenthal was the ultimate activist attorney general. And George Jepson has been less so, although certainly behind the scenes in negotiating settlements, absolutely the case. And we have yet to see, and we don't know, and the campaign is not positioned, it's not designed to have that trait come out. And so what we talk about is ideology. What we really need to know about is activism.
I think we know. I think we know that Matty would be more like Blumenthal and that Tong and Doyle would be more like Jepson. I think Matty would be the activist among them.
Fair enough. I would say that Tong has the ability to emerge as an activist.
But before we break, I want to go to Danny very quickly and ask about a candidate that we have not yet talked about, because he does not reside currently within either of the two established political parties. His name is Oz Griebel. He's a longtime Republican. He's run for this job before, and he's trying to, you know, get on the ballot, because if he gets on the ballot, then people might be able to vote for him. And everything turns a lot different for a Ned Lamont or a David Stemmerman or a Mark Boughton if Oz Griebel's on the ballot. So where is Oz right now?
Well, it's I got an update this morning from our friend Chris Cooper, who's a staffer with Oz Griebel and Monty. And the numbers look good for him to get on the ballot, but it has come at a very high cost in terms of both volunteer power and time of his own. As of July 31st, the Secretary of the State had certified 3,800. He needs 7,500 certified signatures of registered voters from, I believe, either party. They don't have to be independent, right? They can be in a party. So correct me if I'm wrong on that. He has, as of today, 5,400 more that he will submit. He has been going at a rate of 90%. That is, of the 3,800, 90% of those were good, right? And that's quite in contrast to what we saw with, for example, Joe Ghanem, who got 13,000 out of 32,000 knocked off, more than a third. So if he does all that, the bottom line is he's got a cushion, but it's not a huge cushion. He's got a cushion of a few hundred, and they have until September 5th to certify, so he could be waiting and waiting.
Let us put aside your number crunching for a moment, the
yes.
cushion, the whether or not he is able to be certified, and let's just talk about those raw numbers. So if we're struggling to get 7,500 signatures, and the entire campaign is predicated on the notion that you have to get signatures to get on the ballot in the first place, and the entire campaign has been about doing that very thing, and here we are in August, and you haven't gotten maybe the 7,500 signatures, how in the holy crap would that translate into an Oz Griebel victory or anything that looks like momentum that could change the course of the race in November?
He's waiting for both parties to melt down at the same time. So magic, lightning has to strike. Both parties have to have a candidate who is viewed as an extremist. And it could happen. If Ghanem wins and Stefanowski wins, Oz Griebel could win. If Ghanem wins and Herbst wins, Oz Griebel could win. There's a path to victory. It's very, very slim. I would say that for Oz Griebel, it would be an eye-opener, except that he already ran in 2010 and had an eye-opener then when he wasn't able to raise money. So it's a double eye-opener. The difficulty of getting support is really, really hard in any state when you're an independent.
But that's really hard, Keel. I mean, he's facing some really difficult numbers. And as Danny said, lightning's got to strike. Everyone else has got to melt down. Earthquakes, hurricanes, cats and dogs living together. There's an awful lot that has to happen before Oz Griebel could make any sort of a real difference in this campaign, just by the numbers, it seems.
Yeah, I saw him at a forum in New Haven last week, and he didn't seem entirely prepared. Maybe it's just because it was a forum about arts and how that affects the economy. I don't know if that's just not his thing. But it does seem, and I think he told, I don't remember which outlet, I think it might have been The Current, that he was surprised at how difficult it's been, which surprised me because he's done this before. And then the other thing I will say, just to make this point, should Ghanem somehow win, he and Oz is on the ballot. Oz and Ghanem will be significantly underfunded. Oz is not taking public funding, and Ghanem has to, he can't take public funding. So they both will have that hurdle to overcome as well.
And it's a big hurdle. Colin?
I don't know. Most of us know Oz, and I think most of us like Oz. He's a good guy. He's somebody you'd be willing to hang around with in a non-political context. However, when I read the thing about the signatures, I had what Lyndon Johnson used to call a heavy heart. Because the knock against Oz is he doesn't have a fire in the belly. And, you know, he's just really not in there in this very adrenalized eye of the tiger, pick your cliche mode. And one of the ways we judge candidates who have not been office holders is how they solve the problems of the campaign. It's actually a point in favor of Stemmerman. Stemmerman hired the best possible people. He could afford to, obviously, but he hired the best possible people, put together a terrific campaign team. You have to solve the problems of your campaign because that's one of the ways we judge you. So the fact that it's going right down to the wire here on these signatures, I mean, it's not that hard. Joe Visconti did it. So it's not that hard to do this, you know, but you do have to work at it really hard. You have to identify it as your biggest priority. It's the only thing that matters until you can get campaigning. You know, in other words, if you don't solve this problem, you're not in the race. So you have to prioritize it. It seems like he didn't do that. That worries me a lot. And I don't think it says a great thing about his campaign.
So let's take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about how the 3D printing of firearms has entered itself into the political conversation here in Connecticut, and a few other things about the week's news that we'll talk about with Colin McEnroe, with Caitlin Kresselt, and with Dan Haar. Here in the Wheelhouse, I'm John Dankosky. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky, talking about the week's news with Colin McEnroe and also with Caitlin Kresselt and Dan Haar, both of Hearst Connecticut Media. There's a nationwide battle going on to halt the online dissemination of blueprints for the 3D printing of firearms, the sort of thing that a couple of years ago we didn't really think was going to be an issue. In Connecticut this past week, Republican State Attorney General candidate Susan Hatfield came out and said members of both parties are rightly troubled by the possible risks posed by 3D printer guns. Very soon afterward, Hatfield lost the endorsement of the Connecticut Citizens Defense League. You know, we haven't really talked about that side of the race, but here's one little piece of information, Colin, that seems to suggest a bit about what a section of the Republican electorate is really thinking a lot about right now.
Well, I mean, first of all, let's go to the CCDL for a second. I mean, you know, in a way they, you know, often position themselves as defenders of the Second Amendment and hunters' rights and blah, blah, blah. But and they don't like being called gun nuts. I'm sorry. You guys are gun nuts. I mean, if you're nuts, if you really think that these ghost guns, these 3D printer untraceable guns are a really good idea or that they fit into any coherent vision of the Second Amendment, that's complete nonsense. And the problem with all this is there's a lot of problems. One of them is this technology is out there. You're probably not going to be able to stop it now. It's going to get into the wrong hands sooner or later. And that's the next problem with it. Look, the people who are gun fanciers, they want to own a Sig Sauer or something. They want to own guns whose brand names they know, whose histories they know, they're familiar with them. Or if they're hunters, they want, you know, a very high accuracy rifle. They don't want some piece of plastic junk that came out of a 3D printer. You know who wants that? Some kind of nut who wants to go do some horrible thing and maybe can't even get the gun, you know, because of his priors or whatever. So, I mean, first of all, kudos to Sue Hatfield, I guess, for pushing back against this. It seems like a low bar to clear.
Take off the I guess. I mean, that's in a Republican primary, that's a hard thing for someone to come out and say they're going to do.
Kudos to her.
Yeah.
Of course, and she can throw the discus, too. So, I mean, she has a weapon that she can use on her. She's like a really great athlete. She was like an all-state basketball player and, I think, a very talented discus thrower.
I did not know this about the discus.
Yeah.
Oh.
And both of
them.
Augie Wolf had the shot put. She's got the discus.
Did you want to comment on 3D printing of guns, Danny?
Yes, I did. Right now, the gun industry is reacting with a surprisingly blasé response, and that includes the Newtown-based National Shooting Sports Foundation, as well as some gun people that I talked with.
Is that because people can print their own guns and not buy them from them?
Well, no. You would think. You might think. You might think that they would believe that this is a potential threat to the retail manufacturing distribution system of guns if people can make them at home. What they're saying across the board is, look, we just don't believe that this is a viable alternative to gun ownership now, both because of what Colin is saying and, more importantly, because at the moment it takes tens of thousands of dollars and a whole lot of skill to make one of these right now. And we get that, as George Jepson said in joining the lawsuit out in Washington to block the release of the plans, it's technology changes fast, and we do get that. But at the moment, it's a distant thing. This isn't now a viable alternative and won't be for a little bit.
Could we just spend the last couple of minutes talking about something that is a real thing right now? Facebook, other social media platforms deciding to remove programming by InfoWars conspiracy theorist Alex Jones. The ACLU kind of on Alex Jones' side. Chris Murphy, a lot of other lawmakers saying, no, this is exactly the right move. So Chris Murphy inserting himself into this. Of course, Alex Jones, very important in court right now against some Sandy Hook families because he spread conspiracy theories that what happened to their children didn't happen, which is, I suppose, the most vile thing one can do right now in public life. But anyway, Danny, what do you see in this debate?
Chris Murphy got pummeled on Twitter late Monday and yesterday. Really pummeled, surprisingly not divided. He was really hit hard on Twitter over this because him saying that it's the future of the democracy depends on it is a little bit too far for people to sort of broach. But it comes down to whether Facebook is a public square or a private company. And if you believe that Facebook is a public square, then you believe this needs to be stopped. And if you believe it's a private company, then you believe it's not a First Amendment right. And that doesn't divide on ideological grounds. It divides on something else.
It divides on something else. What do you see in this debate, Caitlin? Because, you know, this whole idea of the internet being something that is both driven by these private companies and also something that's open for everyone to use. When Alex Jones and InfoWars gets shut down by Facebook, is this a First Amendment issue?
That is a good question. I don't really know. I don't think that it is. I think, I don't know. I kind of fall on the end that Facebook is a private company and they have a right to decide, you know, that it violates their terms of service. But at the same time, I also see the public square argument where at this point, so many people use it and you have a right to voice your opinion. If your opinion is harmful to others and you're saying horrible things about the victims in Sandy Hook, I don't know. Should you have a platform for that?
At the end of the day, Colin, words have implications, and there's a reason why there's certain things you can't say in public because you incite violence. And it is suggested certainly by many people that the words that Alex Jones and his supporters use incite violence against people who have already had great violence perpetrated against them.
All these tech giants have to make the kind of decision that Danny and Caitlin are talking about right now. And so Facebook went for a long time with this kind of wide open public square model. And they said, we're not a media company. We build this thing and then people populate it with stuff, you know, and we don't get too involved in what that stuff is. And, you know, I mean, basically that model has been publicly rejected at this point. I think everybody agrees after the Russian hack and stuff like that Facebook has to act more like a media company. They ultimately have to make some decisions. If you pick up a Hearst newspaper, you're not going to find an op-ed by Alex Jones because they would make that decision. We're not going to run his nonsense and his crap and his harmful invective. And I think ultimately these tech giants are going to have to make maybe slightly, you know, watered down versions of that kind of a decision.
I think if they are viewed as to the extent that they're viewed as a public square, there's a conflict with how they're treating the rest of media, because Facebook is using not just what people are posting, but what the media wants to get out there as a commercial entity, as a competition.
Of course, right? They are.
That is, if at Hearst, we need to pay Facebook money if we want to get our message. And this is a similar issue with cable, where we've developed this system that's sort of public and sort of private, and we don't know what to do with it. And we're going to have that problem going forward with both Facebook and, to a lesser extent, Twitter.
Danny Haar is editor and columnist at Hearst Connecticut Media. Dan, always good to see you. Thanks for being
here. Thank you. Great to be here.
Thanks to Caitlin Krassel, who's political reporter at Hearst Connecticut Media as well. Thank you so much, Caitlin.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks to Colin McEnroe. He's the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on Connecticut Public Radio. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Our program is produced by Scott Brady. Our executive producer is Katie Tolarski. Kion Wolf is the technical producer. Summer intern Zandra Ellen also helped out with the show. And Carlos Mejia is the one to thank for us being on digital and all of our other platforms. You can always continue this conversation at WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. Thanks for joining us.